This episode is brought to you by The Manor, a premier addiction treatment facility in the hills of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest. Their program offers a tailored approach to those struggling with addiction in a secluded setting with no more than 11 men and women. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love are struggling with addiction, call The Manor at 414-930-1930. That's 414-930-1930. You can learn more about The Manor by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting discoverthemanor.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
Falling squares on TV screen.
I'm Dr. Chantel Thomas, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. This episode is part one of two featuring my conversation with Dr. Chantel Thomas. And we had a blast doing this. We got enough sound for two episodes that are each going to be about an hour long, and I edited out probably the better part of an hour just of us cutting up. So it was a lot of fun. And Dr. Thomas also has a podcast of her own coming out in the very near future. So I'll keep you posted about that. I'm excited to hear it. But in the meantime, here you go with part one, Dr. Chantel Thomas.
Excited to be here talking with you.
I'm very excited to have you. You know, we've had the opportunity to get to know each other a little bit over the past few months.
Indeed.
And we have a mutual friend who is very dear to both of us. I think it's safe to say, right? Mr. Tilton.
Absolutely. Mr. Ed Tilton.
Yeah. And then we've had an opportunity to collaborate some, especially lately, right?
That's right. Just this last weekend.
Which has been quite exciting, to say the least. But it's been a pleasure already, and I'm happy to have you on the podcast. And so why don't you tell everybody what you do?
So I'm a clinical psychologist, and I am the executive clinical director of a treatment facility in Slinger, Wisconsin. And that is known as The Manor. Mm-hmm. And I also do some work with Victims of Violent Crime Program in Dane County for the district attorney's office. So I do some crisis responding to folks who've been through violent crime. And then I'm also involved in in a peripheral research capacity at the University of Wisconsin with some of the clinical trials there. So I wear a couple different hats.
Yeah.
And I also have two girls.
You do. And one of them is named after E.E. Cummings. You told me that, right?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eslin.
Yeah, which is his middle name. Is that right?
Yeah, Edward Eslin Cummings.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did a, what's the word for it? In undergrad, I was actually an English lit major in undergrad and did a, my final thesis on E.E. Cummings. Mm. And that's when I discovered the name Eslin, which I've always thought was really, I like names that you can't tell that are gender neutral.
Okay.
Like they're fun.
Where'd you grow up?
So I was born in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Owen Sound.
Which is where?
It's in Ontario, and it's small town. At the time, the way they would describe it to me is that it had a hospital and a hockey rink.
Wow.
Yeah. Very small town. Because my father, actually my parents were both from South Africa. And my brother and sister were also raised in South Africa. And my father is a general practitioner at the time. And on his way to immigrating to the United States, he went via Canada. And that's where I was born.
Hmm.
And so then...
Interesting.
Yeah, so... they went via Canada. I think they spent about 2 or 3 years in Canada and then to California. Southern California is where I ended up in the early part of my formative years, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
In Simi Valley. Yeah. So I grew up in Southern California.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you lived out there until very recently, right?
Yeah. So, well, when did I come to Wisconsin? I moved to Madison in 2008, actually. It's been a while.
12 years ago.
2008, 2009 to finish. So I was doing my, I got my master's from Pepperdine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started my doctoral program in San Diego. And so for the last part of the doctoral program, I decided to apply for internship abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied to like 13 different sites. And one of them was Madison, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin, because they had my area of specialization in my graduate school program was in the area of health psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a very unique program at UW where health psychologists are embedded throughout the hospital. So, and in particular on the medical surgical units and also on the physical rehabilitation units of the hospital. So it was this really interesting merger between medical and the psychology world. And so a lot of the work that we did there was in helping people adjust to traumatic accidents or providing a lot of normalization of their distress, because most of the time, you know, we'd get consulted to see a patient because they were, you know, quote unquote, crying a lot or distraught. And then you go in to meet with the patient and you discover that they've been in the hospital for like 6 weeks and they have an infection that has made it difficult for them to eat. And they haven't been able to walk outside and they haven't been away from their family for this long. And most of the time, the notes that we would end up writing were like, well, this person's distress is completely appropriate in the context of their circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really where I came to. It was a really interesting window into the culture of the Midwest, because I was shocked at the resiliency that people had. And I oftentimes would leave hospital rooms thinking there's no way I would be doing as well as that person under these circumstances.
Hmm. So you see that as a Midwestern thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, I realized as I was saying it that I think there is a bit of that because, you know, and there's both sides to that, right? Like, the Midwestern, at least the Midwesterners that I have had a lot of contact with are not complainers very often. This is obviously gross generalizations, mm-hmm. right?
I'm just
speaking about this region. I can just imagine people going, what the hell?
No, but
they're not. A lot of the folks that I would meet with they just wouldn't complain about their experience very often. They were generally, they had a lot of confidence in the medical teams and, you know, they just seemed very resilient. Mm. And I think, you know, at the time I thought, well, this is super interesting because I thought about kind of the inclement weather and like the history of being in the Midwest mm. and what you have to endure outside and like living in inclement weather and kind of the hardships of farming that, mm. that there was a lot of farmers that we treated in the hospital, mm. Who would like be driving a combine that would roll over on them. It would cut off their arm. They would pick up their arm and walk to the emergency room.
Oh my gosh.
Just like extraordinary toughness.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's a dissociative, you know, self-protective numbing that's happening, right. But even still, it was really interesting coming from California because energetically it just felt like a very different population.
Yeah. I wondered if you were going to talk about the weather because that's where I went in my mind, and I'm from Indiana, so you know I don't mind.
You guys consider yourself you would call yourself Midwesterners? Is that is that accurate?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Big Ten, you know.
Big Ten.
Big Ten's Midwest. Yeah.
Right.
Those states like Kansas and all of those out there, they call themselves Midwest too, but I don't, you know, to me, they're out West.
Right.
I think, living in Florida, I love connecting with Midwesterners.
Yeah.
Less superficial.
Uh-huh.
More grounded.
Yeah. That is the lack of superficiality is lovely.
Mm-hmm. And, also, the work ethic.
Yes.
The work ethic is really strong. And, you know, it's funny. I have a client who actually is from my hometown. We found out on his first session with me, which is so interesting. But we kid around about how, you know, are you going to go to your dad's funeral? Or, well, I don't know if I, as long as I can get off work. You know, like it's that kind of commitment to work, like nothing gets in the way of work. And I think, you know, there's some good in that, but, you know, I think happiness is more important and family is more important. And I've definitely changed my approach over the years with work and, given myself a break more. And, but yeah, it's Midwesterners tend to be good employees,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's for sure. Especially stand out in a really big way down here. Midwesterners mm-hmm. and Southerners stand out mm. as really great, having great work ethic.
I will say one other thing that I've noticed is that I really appreciate is that, follow through. Is also really stood out to me coming from California to the Midwest, that when people say that they're going to do something or they offer to do something, they consistently follow through.
Right. So you got to the University of Wisconsin And you were doing, did you say your doctoral program there? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was finishing. Yeah, no, I was finishing my internship. So it's the last part of the cycle of training prior to receiving my PhD.
Okay.
And so working on my dissertation remotely and doing my internship hours. Mm. And then I stayed on there for another year to do an additional year of fellowship training in the same department.
So then I assume that's how you ended up connecting with the Manor?
So I went from there to working in community health at the Access Community Health Centers. There's three of them in Madison. And as something called an integrated behavioral health consultant, where, again, like you would go see your primary care provider and you would talk to them about a sore knee or a cough, and maybe you would start getting like a little emotional in the session, and, you know, the doctor would check in. As most primary care providers do, they have a pretty good radar for assessing when people are struggling emotionally. Mm-hmm. And if they determined that something was going on, they would say, well, would you like to meet with a counselor or a therapist while you're here? And so as fully integrated behavioral health consultants, we basically kind of sat side by side by medical providers and saw people on the fly when they were there to meet with their medical provider to provide them with support. And, you know, sometimes it would just be helping to connect them to long-term therapy. And sometimes it would be in the moment problem solving or just providing them with some strategies. And some of that would involve consideration of medications that might be helpful as well. So I did that for almost 7 years. And in that time, one of the clinics that I was working at was also the home base for the University of Wisconsin family medicine residency. So the family medicine residents would rotate through there. And in that clinic in particular, because of my interest in treating substance abuse, because I'd been in the health psychology world, but my real passion is treating substance abuse, I partnered up with a doc there named Randy Brown, and together we developed a clinic, which was inside the primary care clinic, that essentially treated people with substance use disorders who maybe weren't quite ready to seek out traditional, mm-hmm. Care, but knew they were drinking too much, or maybe they developed a problem with, opiates. And so we would do, basically supportive interventions and behavioral coaching and supporting them in getting into a higher level of care for folks who, you know, would normally just come into their primary care doctor. Hmm. And so through that opportunity, I also had a chance to, Dr. Brown had a fellowship, an addiction medicine fellowship. So training doctors how to treat addiction problems or substance use disorder problems. And so he would have one or two residents, fellows through that program. So mm-hmm. some of them were already physicians for some period of time. And I would support them in their training from like the behavioral therapeutic side of mm-hmm. how to support folks who are struggling with some sort of addictive process. And it was one of those fellows who left the program and got headhunted by an outside agency for this program in Wisconsin. And when she was being recruited for a different program, they asked her if she knew of any therapists that might be interested in running a treatment program in Wisconsin. And she mentioned my name.
Wow.
Which was pretty interesting, because the style of treatment that we do here is much more aligned with a lot of the programs that exist in California, and maybe some of the ones that exist in Florida as well.
In what way?
Well, some people would refer to it as luxury treatment. Mm-hmm. I don't love that label. Mm-hmm. Way that I would say it is that, kind of circling back to the Midwest concept of, it's a very holistic program that is about really supporting people in doing deep work. But while they're doing that, it's allowing them to be really nurtured from an environmental standpoint. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the beds are really nice and comfortable. The food is great. There's a personal trainer. Body-based therapies are built into the program. So a lot of our clients will end up saying, you know, this is really hard work, but in some ways it feels like a holistic retreat as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, and it, in that regard, I think what's super interesting to me is a lot of our clients feel almost like they don't deserve being treated this nicely when they're at such a, you know, pinnacle of despair or disappointment in some of the choices or the things that have happened in their lives. And so some of the rooms are really big here and they're really beautiful. And, you know, I've had a client come to me and say, you know, this room just feels like it's a bit too much for me. Mm-hmm. Can you move me to a smaller one? Mm-hmm. Which, of course, those are the clients you want to keep there and say, you know, if we can figure out a way where it feels therapeutically healthy for you, I think you deserve this, mm-hmm. you know? It's kind mm-hmm. of a neat, it's this really beautiful opportunity to be able to care for people in a way that they just don't feel deserving of.
Mm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think this is part of the shame associated with addiction and substance abuse. And then also, you know, there's a lot of scarcity sort of mindset mm-hmm. in our culture. And I mean, I've still, part of me struggles with that, where do mm-hmm. I deserve this or do I, you know, and, mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote a little piece, over the weekend, just a post I did online about, it was a meme that said, you're not supposed to hate your job. Because we have this belief system in our country that, oh, well, that's what makes it work. Well, mm-hmm. really? A third of your life? Like, do you really want to spend a third of your life doing something you don't want to do? Because you're supposed to, like, have 40 hours a week and benefits and raise a family, whatever, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's this box that we, and one of the things in my personal growth over the last 6 or 8 years has just been challenging all that stuff, you know, you only live once. Why not do what you want to do?
Totally.
And that's part of why I'm doing this podcast, because I think we would be better off if more of us were doing what we wanted to do with our time. And I believe if we are there, if we're doing that, then spiritually, you know, everything will align. You'll have what you need to be your best and to be fruitful. And, you know, I just really believe that because I've experienced it, you know, when we're in the right place, doing the right thing, things tend to work out. And I've had the opportunity to help create a program that kind of was met with the same kind of attitude, like they don't need that, you know, they need to be humbled, you know.
Yes,
really. Okay. Well, and you know what, when we were full and you know, had a waiting list, and you know, they started doing things that we did,
Yeah.
Because they saw that it worked and people stopped saying that kind of stuff. And I think that's one of the hard realities of the industry is that, you know, there really is a haves and have nots sort of aspect to it.
Yeah. There's such disparity, I think.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the town where I grew up, most of the programs are outpatient. A lot of them are medication assisted treatment sort of based because that's what insurance covers. The length of stay isn't determined by what the client needs. It's determined by how much the insurance covers. And they've just gotten into the habit of doing that. And so when they think about substance abuse treatment, that's what they think of. And the idea of, and it's just amazing. Like, I believe God just wanted me to have good treatment and to do this kind of work because for the most part, a kid who comes from where I did, especially at that time, just doesn't move to Florida to go to treatment at a Hazelden facility. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
Definitely not from a working class neighborhood in a blue collar town. So, it was really a gift, that I relished and took full advantage of it, and stuck around. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's another agency that I do some work with that, you know, they kind of are known as, being, a very high-end facility and expensive, but also have kind of just decided, you know, we're going to own this and realize that we have an opportunity to do the very best work that we possibly can. And maybe we can't treat everybody, but we can influence the industry and raise the bar. And I think that's something that, you know, a facility like the Manor is perfectly capable of doing if they're not already, you know?
Yeah, I think there is, it's interesting because when I was working in community health, right? I mean, it was a very interesting transition to go from working with, you know, the majority, I would say at least a third of the patients that I would work with in community health care didn't have insurance. And then probably at least 50% of them were on state, you know, state assisted insurance programs, Medicaid or Medicare. And I found that work incredibly meaningful, but what was really challenging for me, and I loved what I was doing, but what I yearned for was the opportunity to go a bit deeper. And we just didn't have, the way that the program was set up, because it was population-based care, it was about helping as many people as possible to rise, you know, kind of to raise everybody up and, to help the health of the folks who are greatest in need. But there is a luxury to being able to afford the time and the space and to be able to have a certain level of privilege to set the intention to do really deep work on yourself. And I think that's a little bit heartbreaking on some level that privilege has to come with that. Because I think so many of the folks that I treated in community health were in so much survival mode. It was literally about surviving that they didn't have, you know, the opportunity to question whether or not their life had enough meaning because they were panicked about where they were living. And, and yet, you know, I thought about, okay, stretching different muscles, right? Like crisis intervention and case management, which I did a lot of in that environment, and just had so much respect and admiration for the resiliency of a lot of the people that I worked with. Of course, it was disproportionately people of color for reasons that are probably pretty clear, sadly, that didn't have as many opportunities or didn't have as many resources. But I knew for my stamina in the field that if I wasn't if I didn't at some point in time have the opportunity to go a little bit deeper with people in the connection and also in the type of work, that I could feel myself getting burnt out with, you know, bouncing along the surface of crisis management. And so while there's like this opportunity to work in an environment like this, where people get such intensive therapy, is really satisfying because the work, you really see transformation happen when you get to front load so much work in such a short period of time, and you put a lot of thought and intention in what it means to create a therapeutic environment. And when everybody is on the same page with the same goal of helping people to feel safe and evolve and grow, like really inspiring things happen in front of you, all the time. But the pressure that I personally feel to make sure that we are, delivering the level of care that people deserve is, you know, it's, I always have to be kind of mindfully watching that, because I realize that when people invest in treatment and they make a significant financial investment, that I don't care if you have a ton of resources or not, that in order to keep the relationship feeling really healthy and authentic for me, I need to know that we're giving of ourselves as much as is healthy and is possible to facilitate, you know, that change.
Hmm. That's great. You know, when I started my career, I was really lucky to be around some just fantastic people in the industry. Hmm. And, you know, they talked about this, like they came from a place of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I have seen absent in a lot of, you know, being someone who's been around in different treatment facilities and interacted with staff members from a ton of different facilities. I just felt like it was really special to kind of come up around people who had that attitude.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, there was a bar and you needed to meet it or exceed it. And it was about providing good treatment. And, you know, we held ourselves to high standards. It's nice to hear someone talk about that. And I'm not saying it doesn't exist. Of course it does. But, you know, I wish there was more of it. You know, I think we see a lot of places that are philosophically invested in what they do and their approach and all that. But I think they don't always think about, is this the best approach?
Well, and I think, I mean, I have a lot of compassion for people who go into this industry. Like, I think, you know, those folks who've been in recovery, their recovery journey is part of what fueled them to go back in and provide support for others, right? But I mean, I was just saying to a client today, like this, it is so humbling. Like it's a process, that requires extraordinary humility. At least for me, which I'm grateful for certain, but that balance of, you know, I mean, we know that treating addiction is so complex, and that even when you're firing on all cylinders and doing everything you can, that the kind of insidious ways in which it hooks into people and the points at which you have access and don't have access I mean, that's part of what's exciting about treating it, but it also requires a level of onness as a clinician that I think is just, it's really taxing. And what does it mean to really take care of yourself sustainably as a clinician who's treating folks who may desperately want to get better, but there's a part of them that is working equally hard to maintain the same forms of hiding. Like I've done my best and I know I could do better to cultivate an environment among the treatment providers that, that feels supportive, and feels like a familial connected space. And I know I have a lot more work to do on that, but I think if you can't lean on your team, and share the experience of defeat at time and victory at other times, and the rigorous with which you have to keep examining your agenda. I mean, it's really taxing.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people just kind of, they just feel like on some level, if they don't know how to take care of themselves, they don't know how to sustain it. And then maybe they fall on, you know, certain aspects of the program. And I think the easiest reflex that I've noticed in the industry at times is to over pathologize the client or the person who's suffering, so that anytime they bring up anything that feels uncomfortable or that pushes you or challenges you, that the explanation is, oh, well, that's just their disease. That's just the addict talking. And I think it's really, it can be really dangerous for people.
Yeah. That's something that over the years I've become more aware of, you know, and I might've mentioned this to you in one of our other conversations, the term codependency, the way it's thrown around and used as a label. To pathologize someone and explain away, like, especially when it comes to romantic relationships, because, you know, so I'm a 20, I got sober at 23 years old. I was going to stop smoking pot. I was going to stop drinking alcohol. But, you know, if beautiful girls were paying attention to me, like, forget about it. Like, I'm sorry. I'm not. Now, I'll do whatever I have to do to overcompensate. I did that, but, you know, I'm a 23-year-old kid. Come on. So it was just unrealistic.
Yes.
And you know, I take exception to the idea of telling a young person there's something wrong with them for wanting to engage in a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
Because we're wired to pair bond.
Yeah. For connection.
Yeah. So and you know, we say these things like, you know, relationships will put Miracle-Gro on your recovery. And we know that growth really takes place in relationships. But then we tell people not to get into them.
Right. Because they're too complicated.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And they're too triggering. And yeah, I mean, I'm so with you on that. I mean, every time we get a younger person in here, and it's, you know, we tend to have a more mature population, but we do take folks who, young adults at times. I mean, I think the big question there, and I think this is where sometimes people fall a little bit too much in love with their philosophy about, because I think it requires more work to keep asking yourself the question, based on what I know about this person and what information they've given me, will this actually be implemented in their life in a way that's sustainable? You have to kind of, like, you can know, quote unquote, what you think is the right answer for someone, right? But it doesn't mean anything if what their experience of it is like, well, that's completely unrealistic and I'm not bought into that at all. So then if there's not an adaptation to the stage of change or readiness or even the environmental, social, cultural context of the client, you've essentially abandoned them because you've got this great thing that you say that you think is ultimately going to be best for them. But because it's so unrealistic, there's nothing in between that.
Yeah.
Like what's the alternative? Right. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm also a big proponent of people who come through our program and say, I don't think abstinence is the answer for me. And I say, okay. I mean, we, our aim is abstinence where we feel it's appropriate. And for most of our clients, we think it's appropriate. But when someone starts talking about, well, I don't know if I'm ready to be done with a substance. Like what I always tell everyone here is like, in that moment, be quiet, like, and listen,
mm-hmm.
like pay attention because, you know, we need to know what the narrative is,
right?
You know, you need to know what that person's story is, what they're telling themselves and what they anticipate, what they're actually capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so then let's talk with them about that and create some reasonable safety nets or governing principles that may or may not sustain themselves, but at least it gives them some guardrails. So when they do veer into territory that feels out of control, they can say, oh yeah, we talked about this. And so maybe there is something to that.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes more work though. You know?
Yeah. But if we're getting paid as professionals.
Well, that's the whole thing. Like, what do you view as your responsibility, mm-hmm. right? Like,
Well, no, I'm just another pet peeve that I have is this whole idea that I think if you get paid to treat this illness, and the words, I guess they just didn't want it bad enough come out of your mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, you should go find a different line of work. It's not fair to families. And it's a cop out.
I couldn't agree more. And the phrase that got thrown around a lot in my beginning of my foray into this treatment world was, they haven't surrendered. Right.
Yeah.
They just haven't surrendered. And so that became a tagline for, well, we're going to stop trying.
Right, right.
because they haven't surrendered.
Right.
And this thing is so much bigger than us. There's no point because until they surrender. And I just think about it like, holy smokes, like, think about what it takes for a person to quote unquote surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like completely making yourself vulnerable. It's putting your guard down. It's handing over control. I mean, I just, within my own process, I don't work that way.
Yeah.
And I have to deeply respect and understand what I'm being asked to do. And even then, it's a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, and for some people, their only way to quote unquote protect themselves is the thing that is standing in the way of, you know, giving someone access. And so this is why when I learned about internal family systems and the concept of parts work, which I know that on some level must resonate with you because you and I were chatting about my inner child and lead up to this, mm-hmm. which, you know, Dick Schwartz, developed internal family systems. And I believe he's based out of Chicago actually. And wow, did it transform so much and gave so much language to how I thought about working with people who have, you know, a substance use issue, because it depathologized the concept of the resistant client, mm-hmm. and transformed that language into the concept of, this is the only form of self-protection this person knows.
Right.
And so, so what do we do with that? Do we push harder against the protective mechanisms? Because no client I've ever met yields by being pushed against.
Right.
They just find another way to go deeper into themselves, or they find a better barrier. You know, whether that be popping up into superficial compliance or, you know, some chirpy version of, you know, sure, that's a great point, which they don't actually really believe. They're just trying to get you off their back. Right. And so it's, you know, I say to clients all the time, when you've been through multiple treatment centers, it's probably because the part of you that is the most wounded, the most damaged, and the most, and is hurting the most and carries the shame has never shown up in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Like that part of you just never participated in the treatment experience. Mm-hmm. You're slick, you know, good student, sophisticated, likable version of self was who went through every other treatment center. And that part doesn't need help.
Right.
That part's right. Good.
Yes. Yes.
You know, that guy's good to go. Yeah. That, you know, that woman is good to go. So then it becomes, how do we earn the trust of these, you know, terrified, vulnerable, scared, shameful parts? How do we earn the trust to make it safe for them to show up in treatment?
Well, you know, it's one of the things that's come to mind for me as we're talking is, and you know, this is very much who we are at Feinberg. We believe in people.
Yeah.
I believe in people. You know, there was a time in my career when I had a colleague who we were working on this case together, and John would say, yeah, but you know, he's really, really good at this. And I mean, he was looking at his strengths, and so that was a big lesson for me. But also, you know, we can say we believe in people, but that's different than showing up for them in that way. Yep. Like one of the real concrete ways it has come up for me over the years is, well, are we going to take this person back after they relapsed? You know?
Hmm.
And, you know, I was managing this program where our basic policy was, we'll give people a second chance, but not a third. And so if someone relapsed, we'd get them to detox. And if they would agree to the terms of a behavioral contract I devised, then they could come back. And I would usually sit with the community and at least hear what they had to say about it. And sometimes they would say, well, what if it just happens all over again?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, well, you know, I don't know about you, but I would rather be the kind of guy who's willing to believe in someone than the kind of guy who's not. So, yes, he might do the same old routine over again, but that's a chance I'm willing to take. And
yeah.
And that's, but we have the answers. That's the other thing in all of us. We have the answers. So if we can believe in the client that they are resilient enough to work through whatever it is, like survive, even though they're in an ill-advised relationship in the beginning of recovery, you know, then they're going to trust us more if yes. We believe in them. And it's ultimately, if that relationship isn't solid, there's nothing you can do to help them anyway. You know, another rule that I used to not have is, you know, a lot of these, you know, transitional living facilities, extended care facilities will have a no relationship rule.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just always thought that was crazy because, of course, you don't want them to. But if you tell them not to, they're going to do it. Yeah. And then they're not going to talk to you about it. And the point is you want them to talk to you. And so the last place where I was the program director, I mean, it was a constant battle with one of the owners about, whether we had this rule or not. Mm. And he was just so dug in because that's the way it was where he went.
Right.
But you know, these guys, I mean, mm-hmm. they would date some girl And then they'd come to group and talk to me about it. And they'd get raked over the coals, or they would realize they're going outside of their value system or whatever it was. Yeah. And I would talk through it with them, and they would reach their own conclusion that this isn't what they needed to be doing. And they would stop. Now, it didn't always, it was a lot, it could be messier than that, but that's usually how it worked out. And they made the decision not to do it. So then they were invested in not doing it. And they also had the sort of the rest of the community who they worked through it with.
So. Yes. Yeah. No, I so appreciate that. And I think there's this very confusing piece that I think sometimes can get lifted out of the 12-step community, where it's, you can't be trusted to make any decisions because, you know, your addict or your alcoholic is making all the choices. In the early sobriety, the safest thing to do is just not ever allow yourself to make a decision in solo. Mm-hmm. And the presumption is the addictive voice is the only thing that a client can hear or that an individual in recovery can hear. And this comes up in our treatment center a lot because, I mean, for me, I mean, I have a very trauma-focused lens. And so I believe that everyone that we treat on some level has some sort of a trauma history. And whether that be, you know, big T traumas, like where their life has actually been in danger, or more subtle forms of emotional neglect or relational trauma or intergenerational trauma. And for so many people, they've lost their voice in the process somewhere along the way. They were either never supported in developing it, or their voice, they learned very quickly that their voice, there was no space or room for their voice as a child. Yeah. And that their wants and needs and desires would be weaponized against them, or more importantly, just completely ignored, or they would be punished for those things. And so this is this tricky piece in treatment, right? Where, you know, a client uses their voice and they're trying to figure out what that muscle is. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I literally have seen like literally the all-knowing treatment hammer swings from the sky and just crushes them down. And I know that's coming from a place, I think quite frankly, it's coming from a place of fear on the part of the provider, because the conversation is just a bit complex to engage in. There is the awareness that ultimately you cannot control your client. And there's so many parts of this process as a treatment provider that are out of your control. And so there's this tremendous fear, like, let's shut down every single possible avenue for misstep or for dysfunction. And yet people don't live that way, you know, people, and how do they learn to differentiate from an addictive voice and this piece that you're speaking to, which is, you know, their inner wisdom, their most, their highest self, their most authentic self, which is, again, I'll credit internal family systems from the way that they've used it, is that we all have this capital S big self, which is about, you know, when you're in your highest self or when you're in your most evolved self, you know, you're calm, you're non-reactive, you're compassionate, curious, connected, like all these things. And that is a vital part of what guides you in decision making. But if you tell someone that everything, every instinct that comes from you is part of an addictive and diseased process, you know, where does it leave people?
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.